But the real question to me is, you know, what kind of person do we each want to be? What kind of choices do we want to feel responsible for? What kind of choices do we want to make? I mean, when we are on our deathbeds, are we going to think, man, I'm so glad I got that slightly cheaper chicken, even if it had these impacts that maybe weren't relevant to me personally on my day-to-day life, but I know influenced other people in the world at large? Or are we going to think, you know what? Shoot, I'm willing to spend a little bit more to get a chicken that I know I can believe in how it was raised.
Welcome back to the Real Organic Podcast, Episode 7. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project. We're a grassroots farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label that distinguishes soil-grown crops and pasture-raised on livestock and educates about the differences. You just heard from today's guest, former National Organic Standards Board member Emily Oakley, who lives and farms just a few miles away from those chicken CAFOs in Oklahoma that she was describing. Emily's a hero to mine and every farmer that's trying to figure out how to grow their own fertility on their farm through cover cropping. Emily's heartfelt interview shares many failures of the USDA organic program, and she knows from firsthand experience. To ask us a question or share your thoughts about any of our podcast episodes, please call 347-ORG-FARM. Thank you for subscribing, and be sure to visit our website, realorganicproject.org, to become a real fan. Now let's return to the conversation between my co-director, Dave Chapman, and Real Organic Project farmer and advisory board member, Emily Oakley.
I am talking with Emily today, an old friend. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Dave.
So I'm hoping that we can talk about a bit about your farm career and then a bit about your National Organic Standards Board service and then a bit about the Real Organic Project. So let's start with your farm career. Tell me, how did you get into farming? How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, in high school, have to go all the way back, was really involved in environmental activism. But growing up in Oklahoma, where there is a lot of agriculture, even just outside the city limits where I grew up, I always perceived agriculture as being at odds with the environment. And in high school, I visited the sustainable agriculture farm in Oklahoma and realized that there was another way and that there was this agroecological approach to farming that took nature as its foundation. And I just became intrigued from that point on. And then in college, you know, I wasn't totally sure what I was going to do, but I worked with farmers around the world and got the chance to intern and visit farmers in many different places. And ultimately just came to this conclusion that if I felt like more Americans needed to think about where their food came from and the choices and implications of those choices, that we needed more farmers in America. And not only do we need them in America, we needed them in places like Oklahoma. And for a lot of folks, that might seem like an unlikely choice. But for me, that's where I grew up, and it was a natural fit. And the community that we've built and was sort of already there in essence because I grew up in Oklahoma has been amazing for us. So, yeah, it was one of those, you know, be the change you wish to see in the world situations. And it's been an amazing career choice because we're in our 17th season.
Amazing. Okay, so you decided after college you wanted to be a farmer. Then yeah. What did you do then? How did that turn into actually having 17 years of a farm?
Well, we ended up studying agriculture, sustainable agriculture in college, but you know, what you learn in books and even on internships is not quite the same as putting it more into long-term practice. So we did work with the community gardening organization for a little bit in the Northeast, and then we interned at Full Belly Farm in California, and that's where everything came together. All of the book learning, all of the other experiences, all of the hopes and aspirations were sort of put together in that one place. And going to a really successful, very diverse farm was the best decision we ever could have made. And Full Belly was really generous with us. They let us kind of experience all aspects of the farm in a way we might not have been able to on another internship. And at the time, Full Belly was like 200 acres, and they're much bigger than that now. And we knew we really only wanted to farm a couple of acres, which may not seem like a very likely choice, but it's actually pretty easy to scale down a lot of those systems from a large-scale farm to a smaller-scale farm. And those same scales of efficiency can work on 2 acres as well as they can on 200. So I think if we had not been on that farm and if we had not had that internship, it would have been really hard to come to Oklahoma and have a successful first year. I mean, I also have to give a lot of credit to Eat Well Farm because I went to grad school and Mike continued to work for another year at Full Belly. And he is my farm partner and also at Eat Well Farm. And there he got a lot of CSA management experience. So we kind of both came with different, I don't know, skills to bring to the farm. But, you know, having Mike with 3 solid years of on-farm experience was key.
So I have to go back just for a moment because it's, you know, Full Belly is an iconic American organic farm. And I'm curious what it was like to go there really with a pretty much of an academic experience and get thrown into very much of a working farm. What was that like?
Yeah. Like we'd been at this community gardening place in Rhode Island and it had its own little city farm. And we even had like a community garden plot ourselves and we were members of a CSA and we thought we really knew what agriculture was like. But when we went to California, it was just a totally different level of farming than anything we'd ever experienced or anticipated. Judith, bless her heart, like drove us around and helped us, you know, get from airport to the next place. Because we went really just to kind of visit at first to see if it was going to be a good fit. But, you know, it's really, really hot in the Capay Valley in the summer, but it's really, really hot in Oklahoma in the summer. So the first thing that actually comes to mind is the heat. Like it's a very intense experience there. I think coming from Oklahoma helped adapt me to that. But the community that exists at that farm is so astounding and so amazing. There's just so much heart and so much love for the work that's done, for the people that do the work, for nurturing one another in the process. So it's really easy to go there and just slip into this ready-made home and, you know, feeling of a farm life. So it's, you know, very, very much a part of what Full Belly does to try to grow farmers. And, you know, they really helped us from the beginning kind of experience all the different aspects of the operation.
It's amazing to see these farms that one of their crops is farmers. And that's true of Full Belly. That was true of Elliott's farm. I know, you know, I discovered in this great hydroponic debate that Larry Jacobs of Jacobs Del Cabo started as an apprentice on Elliott's farm and many others, of course. And we have a farm right here in the Upper Valley of Vermont who also started at Full Belly. So you see that these people who are so generous and really see that as part of their mission, it's transformative. So when you were working at Full Belly, and I'm getting the sense that education was very much, they saw that as part of what they were doing with the crew. Did that education include the business of farming as well as the techniques of horticulture?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's where a relationship with Judith was so generous in the sense that she basically made time during, you know, a time when you have no time. Like there's never time on a farm and Full Belly is always so busy. There's never time. But she would carve out time for us to come into the office to look at how the records were kept, how they determined their pick sheet, how they kept logs of all their CSA members, how they did their marketing calls, which, you know, is something that gets missed in a lot of internships. You really know how to weed. You might really know how to harvest and wash and market, but you may not get that record keeping side. And that is key. So that was an incredibly generous aspect of our internship there. And then, as I said, when Mike worked at Eatwell, he also got to be their CSA manager for a year. And that was also extremely helpful. He was writing the newsletter. He was outreaching with members. He was kind of helping pick what was going to be in the basket each week. And getting like increasing levels of responsibility when you work on a farm, I think also helps prepare you from being an intern to taking that leap of having the responsibility of your own place. And there's, you know, there's no one else to call on if things go wrong. You know, it's you that you have to turn to.
You know, I was on the Farmer to Farmer podcast. Probably you were on the Farmer to Farmer podcast too. And I've had several people contact me from years later to say, thank you. That was a transformative thing. It really changed how I farmed. And I, you know, who knew? You know, I'm just farming. And we had that thing. And it was interesting because I divided the time. I said, well, I really want to talk about the organic movement. And he said, well, I really want you to talk about Longwind Farm. And so we agreed 50-50. And the thing that was interesting in Longwind Farm, I talked a lot about how to run a business, because I think that that is the really greatest challenge for most vegetable farms. I don't know about other farms, but for most vegetable farms, that's probably the greatest challenge in terms of surviving, as opposed to how to grow tomatoes, which is good. You need to know how to grow the crops, but people are pretty good at that. Running a business is a bit more. So tell me, you guys got a tremendous education, and you did it together. It's kind of very nice. And you came back. Was Mike from Oklahoma?
No, he's from New York.
Right. So, okay. So a little cross-cultural blending there. And you came back from California to Oklahoma?
Yes, we did.
And
so we took an epic road trip because we knew we would never have another summer off for a really long time. But yes, then we moved back to Oklahoma in the fall of 2003, started looking for land, had a really amazing woman who had just met us reach out to her friends, and someone who didn't know us from Adam said, sure, you can use my land, and sure, you can use my tractor and my barn, and you can build a cooler in it and use water and electricity, whatever you need. I'll take some of those yummy cherry tomatoes in exchange. And we were there for 3 years.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's so many stories of first generation farmers who don't have family land doing something really similar. Because I mean, naively, we thought we would move to Oklahoma and just buy land right off the bat, but didn't quite work out that way. But after 3 years and looking at 150 properties, we did finally find the farm that we're on now and have been on for 14 years now. And we're in eastern Oklahoma.
So one of the, you're farming on how many acres?
Well, we own 20, but we have about 2 to 3 in crops. We have another 2-ish, 2.5 in cover crops and fallow period at the same time. Although my goal would be to get it split equally between fallow cover crop land and production land.
And you are, for me, a prominent advocate or representative of somebody who is growing most of their fertility. Not all. I know that you have some inputs, but fairly minimal. And so you're doing a great deal with cover cropping and growing your fertility right on the farm. And it's interesting because I talk with Elliot about this, and you know, there are these traditions in farming from very, very intensive market gardens, ringing cities since the beginning of civilization, to very extensive fields with cattle on thousands of acres. And of course, on thousands of acres of cattle, they're not spreading anything on the fields. They're growing their fertility. Or, well, maybe they are now, but that's a different story. And in an intensive market garden, typically they're, most of that tradition is to gather manure and green matter from other land and compost it and focus it. But you are growing your fertility pretty much. You're not bringing in much in the way of materials that you're composting. Is that right?
Yeah, we don't compost other than like our home vegetable scraps, or like if we top beets, we'll put that in. We are in an area that does not have a great deal of compost production. That's increased over the last few years, but you know, it's not like California where they have large-scale compost production, or even Vermont, or other parts of the country. So what's used typically here is chicken litter, and that comes with a host of challenges, environmental ones in particular. And we did use that when we initially bought this farm. We had 5 pounds of nitrogen to the acre when we bought it, and it was just an old, I mean, turns out ancient field. It's been farmed for like over 2,000 years, we've learned, in the process of tilling it up and finding the remains of previous civilizations that lived here. But it's not a place that got glacial deposits. It's very old, weathered soils. Like if you speak to anybody who's a soil scientist in Oklahoma, they will call these very old, weathered soils, and they just are not naturally high in fertility. So, you know, when we initially used chicken manure, I think it was out of need. I mean, we could have tried to take years off and build up soil fertility without manure, but it would have been a very long-term process, nor am I sure that that is entirely feasible. It kind of reminds me of the One Straw Revolution. I don't know if you've read that book, yes. But I mean, he used a lot of herbicides actually in the beginning.
Yeah.
And he's very frank about it. And I would not want to use herbicides myself, but I see some sort of similarity in using these basically CAFO manures to build up our fertility levels. But we always struggled with it. We always had environmental, social justice qualms with it. And we're trying to figure out how to use cover crops. But there's very little research out there about using cover crops exclusively for fertility. So we just kind of experimented over time with different mixes, you know, testing our soil at different times during the cover crop period to kind of see what it was doing to nitrogen and other nutrient levels. And ultimately kind of got to a point where we felt confident or somewhat confident in removing manure from our system. And even if we were to buy compost here, a lot of it is going to contain manure, or anywhere it's going to contain manure. And if it contains manure, it's from a CAFO, because there's no other way to gather large quantities of manure other than CAFOs. You know, unless it's a really localized, small scale system of compost manufacturing.
So let me interrupt. I wasn't planning to go that quickly, but let's talk about CAFOs, right? Because first, can you tell people what a CAFO is?
Confined animal feeding operation, where large thousands, typically, or hundreds, depending upon the livestock of animals, are raised in a very small area. In our area, it's chickens. The newest houses that have been built within the last couple of years have 50,000 birds in a barn, and each facility has at a minimum 6 barns. So there are at any given time on a 20-acre parcel or less, 300,000 birds, and they go through between 5 and 6 cycles a year. So that's up to 1.5 million birds on that little parcel of land.
Have you been in some of these chicken CAFOs?
Yes, I have.
What's that like?
I mean, I'm a vegetarian for ethical reasons. And if you walk into one of those, it'll certainly at a minimum spark thought. And it's a very sad, painful sight. Just, it's too many animals in a small space. And it's, you can't take care of that many birds. You know, they are no longer individuals, which, you know, I understand they're for production, but there comes a point where you have to wonder, you know, what happens to us as people when we just see them as commodities and we don't see them as the living beings that they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that Jonathan Safran Foer has said that over 99% of the milk, meat, and eggs in America comes from CAFOs. And I think that most people don't know about this, even though there have been a lot of stories. I think that most Americans have never been inside a CAFO and have no idea that that's where the milk or the meat or the eggs that they're eating are coming from. So one of the things that, before I go there, you actually have been fighting a battle with a CAFO close to your farm. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, we live on one of Oklahoma's most pristine and clean creeks. And a couple of years ago, we learned that 6 of these new houses with 50,000 birds each was planned about a half mile up the creek from us. And it was going to be right on the creek. And I thought, oh no, surely there are regulations that prohibit that. And in my naivete, just started looking for them and started making phone calls and said, I think there's been a mistake here. Of course, I learned later there had been no mistake. There were no regulations or protections. I mean, arguably the Clean Water Act, but certainly no state regulations that would prevent the construction of these houses, not only next to this creek, but right next to the town of Oaks, which is the end of the Trail of Tears for the Cherokee Nation, or one of the end locations of the Trail of Tears, right next to a residential facility for Native American children called the Oaks Indian Mission. It was a neighbor to that property and like a few hundred feet from the school. So that kind of got us going. And there's nothing like something being planned right in your backyard to make you get active, kind of like the Real Organic Project. And turns out there were a lot more people in this area who were upset about all the chicken houses coming in. And they predominantly aren't local residents who are building them. It's people coming in from outside, and it's not Oklahoma-based companies either. So it's kind of hard to make the argument that it's helping our local economy.
Yeah, what's it like to live next door to a CAFO? Again, most people listening to this will have never even seen a CAFO. So what's that like? Why would you care? Why is that a problem?
Well, miraculously, these 6 houses did not get built. It is like an incredible example of a community success story. But we now have so many in our region that even though we're several miles, maybe 3 to 4 miles from the nearest large-scale facility, when there's a north wind and it's blowing right, I'm not sure if we're smelling those CAFOs themselves or if we're just smelling the massive amount of chicken manure that's now being produced in this area and getting spread on cow pastures, both for hay and for, you know, cow-calf feeding operations. But we can now smell manure sometimes at our house, which is crazy. And I've actually had to start keeping a log on a calendar of how frequently and where and how often for how long we're smelling chicken manure. And it is, you know, it's not some pleasant little poop smell like changing a newborn baby's diaper. No. It is one of the most revolting odors you can possibly imagine. And for the very unfortunate people who have to live right next to these CAFOs that have now been built in our area, it's beyond heartbreaking. I mean, what are you going to do? You can't even sell your farm because nobody's going to want to live next to that. You don't want to, and no one else will.
So it's sort of like you're living.
I could go off on a tangent on that, but it's a heartbreaking situation.
It's like you're living in a colonized area.
Yeah, I mean, America is treating rural America as its dumping grounds in many ways. And it's turning rural communities into industrialized places because these are industrialized operations. There is nothing mom and pop about these farms. There's nothing like these aren't, I joke, they're not like grandma's old chicken houses, you know, because this industry has been around for a while. But those first barns were like, you know, kind of a joke compared to these 50,000 birds per barn operations. So.
Well, one of the things that even beyond that, and we're certainly going to get into this with some of the other people in the symposium, is the tremendous climate implications of the CAFOs as being one of the main pressures on climate crisis, on climate change, is growing the food somewhere else, chemically by and large, right? And then transporting it a long way to these basically toxic concentration camps for animals, and that the whole thing is a downward spiral. It's so interesting to me because it's so difficult to stop. It's happening on this massive level. And, you know, people kind of say, well, that's capitalism. And I don't know. It seems to me like it's a very broken capitalism. It's capitalism in which the people don't want it. So Adam Smith's idea of the invisible hand is, I don't think this is what he had in mind. I really don't.
Well, this is capitalism that is invisible in many respects to the consumer. And if it's not in your line of vision, it's not necessarily something you're going to think about or you're going to consider. And when you pick up a chicken at the grocery store, are you going to think about where it came from? I mean, probably not, right? You're just trying to get home to make dinner, which is going to be a hard enough chore in and of itself. But, you know, the amount of manure that they produce and the environmental impact of those nutrients is really great. The amount of water that they consume. People's wells are going dry. Our own spring went dry last year or the year before. Time is now becoming a blur the older I get, which, you know, it has this ancient spring house built over it. It's obviously not something that was intermittent. It was a known well established spring. But when you draw tremendous amounts of water for all of those birds, you know, it's like sticking a city the size of Tulsa in this very concentrated small area without a nutrient management plan, without a water consumption plan. And it's hard to tell that story in a compelling way to urban residents to make them feel like it's part of their story too. But I think that's where the connection to local producers helps, because we've been able to articulate this story to our customers in a way that maybe we wouldn't have been able to otherwise, except that we have such a strong relationship with each of them. And they've been with us for so many years. And they believe enough in the taste of local food, the value of local food, that they care about this issue for themselves, for us, for the broader community and the broader environment. And that has been really instrumental in getting some positive changes in our area.
Okay, so let me ask you, let's say that you lived in New York City, and let's say that you thought climate change was a sham, and let's say that you were mean and you didn't care what happened to the people in Oklahoma. So is there still a reason why maybe you should care about that chicken from a CAFO? Would you, if you were the person I described, I'm sorry, would you still say, good, I'd love to buy the CAFO chicken because it's so darn cheap? In other words,
there always are going to be people like that.
My question is, are there reasons why that person still shouldn't choose the CAFO chicken because it's inferior nutritionally, because it's actually not good for you?
Well, I mean, scientists are always going to agree and disagree about various issues. And, you know, the debate about whether or not that is less nutrient dense than a pasture-raised chicken grown with care, allowed to eat insects, allowed to forage and exhibit its natural behavior. You know, we can debate that. But the real question to me is, you know, what kind of person do we each want to be? What kind of choices do we want to feel responsible for? What kind of choices do we want to make? I mean, when we are on our deathbeds, are we going to think, man, I'm so glad I got that slightly cheaper chicken, even if it had these impacts that maybe weren't relevant to me personally on my day-to-day life, but I know influenced other people in the world at large? Or are we going to think, you know what? Shoot, I'm willing to spend a little bit more to get a chicken that I know I can believe in how it was raised.
Well, of course, a lot of people do that. They buy a certified organic chicken and they buy certified organic eggs. So you have just finishing a 5-year term on the National Organic Standards Board. And I can tell people that that is a heroic act on your part. It's a tremendous amount of time that you put in. It's mostly frustrating and painful work, and we'll talk about that. But I'm curious, because I do know you know, can they trust when they buy a certified organic chicken or certified organic eggs that they're not coming from a CAFO?
Well, I feel like I have particular insight into this because in our area, there are also certified organic chickens. And I will not divulge how, but I did have to go visit a farm that had certified organic eggs. And this was a while ago. This was almost 10 years ago. And I drove by the chicken house, and it looked from the outside like any other CAFO chicken barn. There was not a door open with chickens coming outside. There was no place for them to leave the barn. And it was just a contained chicken house like any of the others you might drive around and see. Now, there are fewer birds in there, but it's not the image that I think a lot of Americans assume when they make a purchase of organic meat and eggs. And it is entirely possible to raise chickens inside exclusively in large areas with a bunch of birds in a house and call it organic, because what they're eating is organic grain and they're not being treated with the same medicines and preventative approaches that a conventional bird would be treated, but they are living in similar conditions in terms of space per bird and access to the outdoors.
So the National Organic Standards Board, I think during your tenure, did pass an animal welfare reform. They passed a recommendation.
Just before mine.
Just before Utah. That's how long it took. Yeah. Okay. And so that would have actually shut down many, many of those CAFO poultry operations that are being certified. These large, we're dealing with large multinational companies. You know, these are big companies who have intimate relationships with the Senate and with the House. You know, they have a lot of money. And even though it passed the NOSB and it went on and it finally passed the National Organic Program and then it even finally passed the USDA, it was rejected by Trump.
It was withdrawn from the rulemaking process.
Yes.
When we had a change in administration. Yes.
So, in fact, I bring it up because it's my understanding that none of the last 20 recommendations passed by the National Organic Standards Board have resulted in rulemaking that actually was enacted. So that's 10 years of recommendations. I'm just curious, as somebody who spent 5 years trying to craft those recommendations, how you feel about that?
It's really disheartening to know that you could spend a tremendous amount of volunteer time on something that is important to you, but is more importantly important to the broader organic community. That you vet through the stakeholders, that you try to find consensus on, and know that the chance of it making it through the rulemaking process is pretty slim. I think it's a little difficult to try to attract people to the board if they know that their work may or may not see the light of day when it comes to being enacted into rules.
Yeah, well, even when some of those people are attracted, it's even harder to get them to be selected for the board now. It's interesting, I was talking to some of the early NOSB members, and they had a very different board than NOSB is growing into now. Let's talk about Jacksonville. Jacksonville was a big turning point in the national organic movement, I believe. It was when a recommendation to basically support the 2010 recommendation that hydroponics should not be certified as organic, and it failed to pass. And it was sort of stunning because in 2010, that recommendation passed 14-1. It was overwhelming, a slam dunk. It's like if something passes 14-1, it's so obvious that it's the right answer. And yet in 2017, we couldn't even get a majority. What was that meeting like for you?
It was really personally painful because the board is intended to represent all the diverse organic stakeholders, and it does. But the number of us on that board that actually make our living farming is really small. And the number of people voting on that decision that make their living growing vegetables was even smaller. And to have people make a decision that they felt was in the, you know, best interest of the organic movement, but that was so at odds with not only my personal experience, but the experience of hearing from so many farmers across the country about that issue was kind of mind-boggling. And I didn't understand, like at the end of the day, I just couldn't understand how they could hear from farmers across the U.S. who were really adamant about not wanting hydroponics, especially vegetable farmers, because we're talking predominantly about vegetable crops, and not understand the weight of this decision on those farmers when the number of hydroponic growers was really small. Like the number of certified organic hydroponic operations was limited. They were a minority, a very small minority. But how their voice managed to carry so much weight, I still don't understand. And I don't understand what other people see in hydroponics.
Yeah. Well, that tiny minority was supported by the Organic Trade Association and CCOF and Oregon Tilth. So they had tremendous institutional support. For whatever reason, well, for obvious, maybe obvious reasons, the industry decided to support this. I mean, we really were dealing with Driscoll's, who is the biggest organic vendor producer in the world of vegetables, of berries. You know, they're bigger than Grimway. They're big. And they're also the biggest conventional berry vendor in the world. So they
have... Yes, because organic constitutes a very small portion of their overall production.
Yes, but growing quickly, they're very pleased with the organic market. And, you know, it's amazing to have such a behemoth neck deep in this debate. And I believe I'm very confident that the reason that the organic industry was supporting hydroponics, even though they said they didn't, was because of Driscoll's. It's a huge, huge company. They cast an enormous shadow. I've talked to a number of California growers who really don't support certification of hydroponics, but they don't want to say it too loudly because Driscoll's owns the neighboring fields. And they felt like they had to get along. So, okay, it was a painful meeting. It was exciting and painful and all that. One of my strongest memories of it was a group of us were going up in the elevator after the first day of testimony, and you were in that elevator, and you got out, and you turned around, you had a big smile on your face, and you said, "That was the most fun I've ever had at an NOSB meeting."
That's because there were so many farmers that had come to testify. And that's such a rarity for the NOSB because right. Farmers are busy. And I thought, oh my gosh, these voices will surely be heard.
Okay. Well, okay. They weren't heard. And I'll tell you, I helped convince a lot of those farmers to go to that meeting. And I can't convince anybody to go to another meeting probably ever again. They sort of are done with it. So after that, there was the creation of the Real Organic Project. And once again, you were pretty important in the path that we took. Well, you were, Emily. You called me. And we were talking about whether we were going to make it a small Northern New England organization representing farmers in Vermont and Maine and New Hampshire. And you said to me, "Dave, Vermont can do this without Oklahoma, but Oklahoma can't do it without Vermont." Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was actually a powerful moment for me. I'm like, okay, we're going to be national. And I got to tell you, it's extremely difficult to do something on a national level with a bunch of disorganized farmers. So
busy farmers, busy, not disorganized.
And disorganized and busy. That's why we're disorganized, because we're so busy. And it's always true. Farmers work so hard and they have so little time to organize and to work together, because they're just so hard to make a living.
Well, the insult in this story is that farmers worked so hard to build the organic movement, to create a label and a word that consumers understood. They paved the way for people like me to come in and be able to say the word organic and not have every single person ask me, "What was that?" But even 17 years ago when I started, people still didn't know what it meant. And to have put in all of those years building up something that was a labor of love. It's not just a job. It is something people do because they truly do believe in it. To have that turn into something that is such a far cry from what they originally created and envisioned is painful and on some level, insulting. And that doesn't mean that there can't be a diversity of organic products out there. Sure, there can be. And people are going to want different things. And there are all different sorts of organic consumers. I get it. But why was this movement created? Why was this label created? What are the cornerstones that are the principles upon which we are all doing this? Because it's sure not for the money. It's for the love, like I said at Full Belly, it is for the love of what we do. It is for the belief in what we do. And I think the Real Organic Project came about because many of us felt like we could no longer share this label with large-scale agriculture that feels very different from what we do or the intentions behind what we do. Because, hey, if organic's so great, then convert all of your production to organic. If you believe in it, why grow conventional anymore? What's the need? So sharing that label and that term with with entities that are there for the profit just felt wrong. And I feel like farmers across the country were screaming for some way to differentiate themselves and to say, hey, wait, this is how we do it. This is why we do it. We believe in this. We are the face of organic, and we are what many consumers still think of when they go and buy organic. But we want to be sure they understand when you buy from us, it's a different story than when you buy from something that is nameless and huge and maybe not in it for the exact same reasons that we are.
Yeah. Yeah. I also believe that there are literally millions of consumers who want to buy that food. And it's, you know, I look at and torn between the tragedy and the opportunity, because I know that so many of the people who are paying the money for the paying the organic premium, it's because they want the food that you grow, right? That is what they're trying to buy. And they want eggs that come from chickens that went outside every day and scratched around in the dirt, not who lived in a concentration camp. And they want, you know, berries that were grown in the ground. So the Real Organic Project is trying to connect the farmers and the eaters. So you were one of the first members of the executive board of the Real Organic Project. And it was amazing. We had so many people join the Real Organic Project who either were former members of the National Organic Standards Board or current members, so that it became impossible to dismiss it as just a group of wackos, which we might be, but it became impossible because all those people went through this enormous vetting process and were chosen by the Secretary of Agriculture to represent us. So I'm curious, what was that like for you? Do you feel that the Real Organic Project can succeed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not a question of can or if, it already is succeeding, because farmers want it to succeed and they will bring their consumers along with them. Because the farmers that are part of this project, by and large, have relationships with their consumers, and we will educate them and are educating them. I'm in Oklahoma, a place that a lot of people don't think of as like an epicenter for radical change, but I can't tell you how many customers have heard of the Real Organic Project on their own, not even through me. And how many people have asked me about hydroponics and CAFOs? And it's not because of me. They are getting this information in other ways because we live in a different world and they care about what they buy and they care about what organic means.
That's exciting.
I think the problem is, you know, I think some of the folks maybe who voted in support of hydroponics feel like it's the wave of the future, or large scale CAFO organic agriculture is unavoidable and this is just what's going to happen. And people like you and me were like the small guys, and you know, we're always just going to be sort of on the fringe. But the fact of the matter is, in terms of the number of certified organic farms in the United States, small to medium-sized farms represents the overwhelming majority of the number of farms that are certified organic. So if we all left the movement, there would be no heart and soul left. And I think what's going to happen is as more and more farmers start using this new label and consumers start seeing it, it will have the viable change that we're hoping it will, because it gives consumers and farmers a chance to distinguish between growing practices. And I think that they do care, or enough of them do, to make a difference.
Yes. Well, that's really exciting. To hope that there will be a bridge to the next generation of farmers coming up. Right now in Vermont, you know, Vermont's a special place. It really, when I got into this some years ago, I actually didn't know about CAFOs because I had never seen an organic CAFO. I'd never heard of one. I just knew the farms in our area, and there are no certified organic CAFOs in Vermont. So, you know, what happens next? You know, where do we go? Where do we go next with all this? Once people do find out about what's happened to the organic brand, there's a conversation that goes on nationally. We have to remember, most farmers don't know what the NOSB is, the National Organic Standards Board, and certainly virtually no consumers, a tiny handful, know what those initials stand for. But they understand the organic seal, and they understand what they mean by it and what they're looking for, and there's no place else to go. You go to the store if you don't want to buy conventional. You have to buy organic, and I was always proud to buy organic. But now I'm very proud of the way I farm. I'm very proud of the way you farm. I'm not very proud of some of the things that are getting certified as organic, which is why we create this. The very fact of having this conversation, though, there are many people, some of whom are friends, who do not want us to talk about the failures of organic, of the organic brand, because they feel that it will undermine what is an amazing success story. It is amazing. At the same time, in Vermont, we are seeing many organic dairy farms going out of business right now. And I believe that's a direct result of the CAFOs coming in and taking the market. They can produce cheaper. Their milk is worth less. The environmental impacts, the health impacts, all these other things that somebody else is paying for are real, but they're not, those costs don't go back to the owner of the CAFO. So what do you feel about that comment that we shouldn't talk about this because it will shake people's trust in the organic seal by telling them the truth?
I think enough people know enough to question the organic seal when it comes to animal welfare. They don't have to go very far. If they look, you know, in a grocery store selling multiple organic eggs, they can see on it multiple organic labels. Some are humane verified, some aren't. Like, the confusion is already out there. It has nothing to do with the Real Organic Project. The reports that have happened in the media have gone a long way towards shedding light on some of the dark sides of organic within the consumer's mind. And you don't even have to read any of those reports to just go into a grocery store and wonder how there can be so much organic production and what do those farms look like. I mean, we had a guy come out and do some backhoe work for us, and his wife is a big organic believer, but he said on his own that how can anything in the grocery store really be organic? How can anything from a farm that is super huge be organic? Now, there are plenty of local farmers selling into grocery stores, and there are definitely products in grocery stores that are certified organic that are legitimate and wonderful and totally worth supporting. But it's a fair question to ask, you know, how can there be this much production under this one label and have it still meet all of the principles of organic? Now, people would say, all right, well, if you're going through the inspection process, organic is scale neutral, and any size farm can theoretically meet those standards. And that is true in theory. The question is it happening in practice? Because small farms can make mistakes and do, but when they do, it's on a much smaller scale. When big farms aren't following the rules, the implications are multiplied by the size of the farm, the multiplier effect of not following the principles or practices is much larger, the bigger you are. And I think it's also fair to say that the smaller an operation is, while it's taxed with, you know, the big job of running a farm, it is probably more likely to come at farming because they're not looking to try to make a ton of money, but because it is something that they believe in for themselves, for their communities, for the lifestyle, for the environmental benefit, for social justice issues. They're way more likely, I believe, and in my experience, having visited so many across the country, to take things like biodiversity seriously. Things that may not get as much attention on thousands of acres. And whether the Real Organic Project has this conversation or not, consumers are already having it. Farmers are already having it. Because the organic marketplace has changed so much in the last 20 years that you don't have to be paying attention to notice the difference.
Well, great. So, Emily, do you have something that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked?
Yeah.
Tell me.
I've said this before, but I feel that when the organic movement, as everyone referred to it, became the organic industry in people's minds and in people's language, that represents a sea change in what organic is. To me, it's not an industry. To me, it's a movement. And we can have different points of view on that. We don't all have to agree. In fact, the National Organic Standards Board is not all meant to agree on everything. We are there to represent different views. But when our fundamental notion of what organic is, or why companies, farms, individuals enter into it, is so vastly different, the fissures are there, whether we do anything about it or not. And what I think Real Organic Project is trying to do, and the reason that I've been involved in it, is that I want to see a way to communicate the values that brought me to organic in the first place. I wish the USDA label did that all on its own. And in many ways, it does. And there are many great people who work at the USDA and in the National Organic Program. But at the same time, in my time on the board, I have just seen an outsized influence that lobbyists, corporations with money have over the voice of small farmers. That's not to say that small farmers should give up on the process, because they shouldn't. If anybody's using paper chain pots, that's a great example of small farmers speaking and being heard. But there aren't enough examples like that. And there are a lot of examples of changes getting made that are made because somebody has a voice that is too loud and it's deafening and it's drowning out the smaller farmers. Even though, as I said, we still represent the majority of certified organic farms in this country. I think the reality is we can't give up on any of it. We can't give up on the organic label. Too much went into creating it. Too much is still at stake. But we also have to be willing to embrace other ways of communicating our values and creating community for ourselves. Because at the end of the day, the Real Organic Project is not just another label. It's actually community among farmers who share these values and our consumers who share them too.
Thank you. Okay. Well,
thank you.
I can't say anything after that. Thank you very much, Emily Oakley. Talking to you always cheers me up. And this time was no exception.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. We hope you will subscribe, tell your friends, and leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you found our podcast. A video version of this interview, as well as the full transcript with links related to today's conversation, can be found at realorganicproject.org/episode7. Please join us next time for an interview with iconic organic farmer and author and rabble-rouser, Elliot Coleman. To find a Real Organic Project farm near you, visit realorganicproject.org/farms. We'll see you next time.